Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
That threat continues to persist. There are still missiles being fired from.
Does that mean that Canada agrees with Israel that Hamas has to be destroyed?
I think they have a right to defend themselves against that terrorist threat, and quite frankly, Hamas has to be eliminated as a threat, not just to Israel but to the world.
Well, good afternoon, friends. Welcome aboard. Rob Breckenridge with you. This is Afternoons on QR Calgary. A lot to get to here on this Tuesday afternoon. That was a little bit earlier today. Defense Minister Bill Blair asked by reporters about whether Canada would push by a ceasefire, warning that a ceasefire could only stand at this point to benefit Hamas, that Israel has the right to defend itself and it needs to respond. Now, I wanted to play this quickly. Just moments ago in the House of Commons, it was a week ago today, that reports began to emerge about an explosion near a hospital in Gaza and an accusation from Hamas that it was Israel that had bombed the hospital. An allegation that turns out to be untrue based on everything that has emerged since then. The Prime Minister was maybe a little hasty in his comments last Tuesday in suggesting that it was the Israelis responsible. A week later, he has finally commented once again on the situation, prompted by a question from the opposition leader in question period today.
When it comes to issues that have such a serious impact on Canadians and on people around the world, we need to make sure we're grounded in facts. That's why I asked our defense experts and our military specialists to analyze open source and classified data to come to a conclusion. And the conclusion is that according to the best evidence that they have, Israel did not fire a rocket at that hospital.
Okay. So there it is from the Prime Minister today. Now, more is beginning to come to light about the horrors that unfolded by Hamas on October 7th as they basically burst into Israel. Through the fence, other ways of getting from Gaza into Israel, and went on a killing spree. Now, yesterday, Israeli officials, in a briefing for journalists, revealed images that had not previously been seen. Video that was confiscated from Hamas fighters of that massacre as it unfolded. Concern on the Israeli part that these atrocities are being downplayed or even denied. But there's no question that it was a horrific attack that Hamas inflicted upon Israel on October 7th, and we're learning more about it. Global News has an inside story today on one particular Israeli community, the town of Sufa, just a few kilometers away from Gaza, just a few hundred people in that community. And a thorough account of what happened on that fateful day. The attack that Hamas inflicted upon the town, but also the way in which residents fought back. The headline, "The Hamas Attack on an Israeli Kibbutz and How Residents Fought Back." You can read much more at globalnews.ca. Joining us on the line here this afternoon, the author of this piece, Global News investigative journalist Stuart Bell. Stuart, great to have you with us here today. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Rob.
Like I say, we are learning more still. I mean, here we are, you know, more than 2 weeks after the fact, but we're learning more about what unfolded in the early hours of October 7th. And that's coming from firsthand accounts. It's coming from videos and images that have emerged. So how do you go about piecing together an investigation like this?
Well, Rob, this attack by Hamas was really unprecedented for the amount of video evidence that has emerged. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were people wearing GoPro cameras taking part in the attack. There was CCTV footage. People, you know, the victims, as they were escaping, they were recording with their phones. So there was a lot of a video, and we're just sort of starting to piece it together. And what we discovered was there were, if you examined a whole series of videos that were taken that you could actually identify a couple of the Hamas fighters and trace their journey all the way from Gaza across the fence and to the community they were assigned to attack. And it's, you know, obviously this is a was a huge attack. There were thousands, several thousand Hamas that took part. There was, you know, mass killings. But just by following two of the fighters, it does give some insights into, you know, exactly how they did it, what some of their motivation may have been. And also, they basically recorded their own crimes.
Well, we've got now approximately 1,400 dead. And so each of those murders, you know, is a horrible story in and of itself. But by sort of breaking it down into pieces, we get better understanding of how this unfolded, because the sheer scale of it all, it's really difficult to comprehend. So this piece that you worked on, as you mentioned, it follows some of these fighters, and we have their video as they go into this community. Now, Sufa is the kibbutz or the town in question here. And it's very close to Gaza, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, most of the communities that were attacked on October 7th were, you know, fairly close to the Gaza border. Mm-hmm. There are quite a few, you know, kibbutzes and towns that are just within a few kilometers of the Gaza border. But the border is quite, you know, it's quite a well fortified border, and I think there was a sense of security for people that live around there. That previously the big threat was rockets that were launched out of Gaza at some of these places. But what happened on the 7th was just somehow basically a mass breakout across the border. They punctured the border with explosives and with using heavy equipment, and they were really able to sail through without meeting any resistance at all. You can see on the series of videos that we analyzed, there was a whole layer of barriers of barbed wire and fencing and concrete, and they just pushed right through and without a single shot being fired at them.
And they had a plan, right? That, you know, they knew where they were going. They knew what they were doing. Maybe they were almost surprised in some way that, you know, they encountered so little resistance along the way. But there was some very detailed plans here, it would seem.
Yeah, I mean, you're exactly right, because you can hear one of the things about their GoPro recording is that you can hear their chatter. And you can see before they reach the border, they're already arming their weapons as if they're expecting to face defenses when they get there.
Right.
And they're almost surprised when they go right through. And they did have a plan. You can, when they reach the border, one of them says to the other that there's 3 kilometers to go, which is the exact distance to Sufa. So they knew where they were going. They had a plan. They were, you know, armed and trained, and they proceeded on. The difference with Sufa, as opposed to some of the other communities, is that the local residents managed to quickly muster themselves, even though there was only a few of them that had weapons. They were ex-military, and they managed to get their act together quickly enough to fend off the Hamas attack, with only ultimately 3 people from the community being killed.
Wow. So this is early morning. You can tell from the video the sun's barely coming up. I guess it's around just after 7 a.m., right, as they're approaching the town?
Surround them. And when you do that, we found the road that they took down through Gaza and crossed the border very easily, as you said, right at sunrise. By that time, there was quite a barrage of rocket fire going out. So people were already on the alert that there was, you know, they were heading to their shelters in their homes, which many Israelis have safe houses that they can go hide in. And it was very quick. I mean, they proceeded within a very short amount of time to the Sufa. They managed to climb in and just basically went house to house, shooting people, shooting at houses, looting, setting fire to houses. At one point, going through a man's fridge and taking something out to drink. And they seemed quite casual about what they were doing as they wandered through the town.
It's interesting. I mean, Israel's a relatively small country, but, you know, some of these towns seem quite isolated. So, you know, as the residents start to comprehend what's happening, there was a real sense, wasn't there, that help wasn't coming, that they were kind of on their own.
Yeah, I mean, the reality is, as you say, these towns are fairly isolated. And so they do have their own civil self-defense teams. So there was a small team at Sufa. There were only four weapons in the entire kibbutz, four rifles. And yeah, they got the call that there was an attack underway. There were people crossing the border. And they quickly threw their equipment on, and they went out, and they confronted the attackers. And it's quite telling when you compare the video of Hamas versus that of the civilians that defended themselves, that you can see the Hamas attackers, they're not moving in a very professional manner. They're not behaving professionally like soldiers. They're just shooting at anything, setting fire to things. Whereas even the civil defense team, you can tell just by the way they're moving that they know what they're doing. They're being careful, covering themselves, and they managed to pick these guys off one by one. And they held them off for about 5 hours until the Israeli forces were finally able to reach Sufa and begin to just really finish off the rest of the Hamas that were there.
It's remarkable because, yeah, I mean, there's military training that, you know, the most Israelis go through. And so that included, you know, the folks in this kibbutz. But as you note in your piece that, you know, there was like a security team for the town, but they hadn't actually really ever trained together. So they weren't really prepared to deal with anything like this.
No, they weren't. It was also a holiday. It was a Jewish holiday in Israel. And a lot of people had family over. A lot of people were tired because they'd been up late the night before. You know, that may have been the strategy of Hamas to attack on that particular day for that reason. But yeah, they did have to muster quite quickly. But it is. I mean, there are some interesting lessons when you go through all of this video and the interviews we did with the survivors and the people that took part in repelling the attack. You can see one that clearly they were expecting to have some kind of battle at the border. You know, they were arming up their weapons as they were approaching the border, and there was just nothing there. So there were some issues with the border where they were able to very easily penetrate. And one of the experts we spoke to had quite an interesting observation too, that he believes that they expected to have quite a difficult fight at the border. And when they didn't, and they made it across, they were almost euphoric and didn't know what to do. And that, you know, that may be the explanation for some of the kind of confusion and excess that we saw, where they just kind of went on a rampage.
Yeah.
So, you know, and also we know from their commentary to each other in the videos that they knew what they were doing. They had a target in mind. They went straight to it. And of course, as I said, by wearing these cameras, and when you also look at the CCTV and other footage, you can see, you know, despite what people have said, what Hamas has said about the conduct of its fighters, they committed, you know, blatant crimes. They just opened fire on civilian homes. They shot into homes. They killed a civilian in this town. Was just completely unarmed, just in his home, in his living room, set fire to homes, all of those things. And so it really is an opportunity to look quite realistically and coldly at what actually happened, as opposed to some of the way it's being portrayed and spun on both sides.
And there is a lot of, you know, frustration, anger within Israel that's directed at the leadership. Like, this is really seen as a failure at so many levels that this happened. And, you know, many are calling it Black Saturday, as you know. But, you know, amid all of that, you know, the story of what happened in Sufa and how these residents fought back, this is kind of like a rare story of success amid all of those failures.
Yeah, I mean, it is. There were a couple of kibbutzes where there were similar things where they were able to keep them off, and those are the small, you know, success stories in a really horrible you know, situation. But yeah, there is a lot of anger at the government. I think at the same time, people are willing to sort of put that aside because they realize that there's a larger issue right now that they're confronting, that I think there will be, people seem to feel that there will absolutely be a day of reckoning for those who were responsible for that massive failure. But right now there's, there's Hamas to deal with and to make sure that it doesn't do this again.
Indeed. Well, your piece on what unfolded in the early hours of October 7th in Sufa in Israel, it's up at globalnews.ca. Stuart, thank you so much for this. Really appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Rob.
All the best. That is Stuart Bell, Global News investigator, journalist. Remarkable piece on what unfolded in this one tiny Israeli kibbutz where a community realizes it's under attack. It's on its own. And they fought back. Now, by the afternoon, some Israeli soldiers did arrive in the town. Only about six, however. But they joined in. So this community was able to take the fight to these Hamas fighters and minimize the civilian casualties there. Unfortunately, Hamas was much more successful elsewhere. As mentioned, the death toll standing around 1,400 at this point as a result of what happened on October 7th. Hey, welcome back. Welcome to this hour of the program. Rob Breckenridge with you. Our number here, 403-974-8255. As a backdrop to our next conversation, there's a new report out today from the International Energy Agency forecasting some big changes by 2030, that nearly half the world's electricity supply will come from renewable energies. The number of electric cars on the road will be 10 times higher than it is right now. They also see oil and gas plateauing over the next three decades. The demand will increase in developing countries, but start to decline in more advanced economies. So they say this transition is happening and it's unstoppable. So what does it all mean for Canada in terms of getting on board with the transition, but also still meeting the global demand for fossil fuels, which is still going to be there in the decades ahead? Now, this all relates to our next conversation, and this whole project is about starting a conversation. It's the McGill Max Bell Lectures. It's happening in three Canadian cities, including Calgary, and Sutherland House, the publisher, is also involved, and it's released the book that our next guest has written. Andrew Leach is an energy and environmental economist at the University of Alberta. He's the author of Between Doom and Denial, which is the McGill Max Bell Lecture happening tomorrow here in Calgary at Studio Bell or at McGill.ca. Andrew Leach joins us on the line here this afternoon. Andrew, great to have you with us. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me back.
So it's a book. It's a lecture series. Just tell us a bit more about this this whole project. What we need to know about this?
Yeah, you basically summarized it well. It's the project was a book to essentially backstop a series of three lectures, or you can think of the lectures being three excerpts from the book. And the book itself, I started off calling it The Little Lies We Tell Ourselves About Climate Change, mm-hmm. and then the title kind of evolved from there as I worked through things that we say, like, you know, Canada's a cold country, so climate change won't affect us, the world will still use oil and gas, so maybe we don't have to worry about our industries being disrupted, or government can plan a just transition and make sure nobody's left behind. These little sound bites that kind of let us off the hook from a more difficult discussion. So I take on six of those in the book and talking about three of them in each of the three lectures, in each lecture.
Right. There were kind of in between two polars on this, very opposed camps. One, and both kind of almost feel like, you know, it comes from a feeling of maybe this is all pointless. Those who say there's no need to do anything, it's business as usual, and those who feel it's so dire, anything short of shutting everything down is pointless. Is that kind of the two camps the title refers to?
Yeah, I think there's that element in the book. And then there are also, you know, whether you think about, I'll use just transitions as an example, that, you know, we hear two camps on that are not necessarily aligned with two camps on whether Canada should act on climate change or how much of a difference we can make or how much climate change policies affect our oil and gas industry or things like that. So I think they're not necessarily kind of two solitudes around each topic. I think there are different people who find themselves annoyed or happy with different chapters in the book.
I mentioned just off the top, the latest forecast from the International Agency. Not everybody necessarily accepts the IEA's numbers or forecasts, but what do you make of some of these forecasts and the pace at which this transition is happening and how it relates to this whole conversation?
You know, I think the IEA is pretty careful to say, look, we're sketching out three different sort of plausible scenarios. If the world acts aggressively on climate change, this is what things might look like. If the world sticks with what it said it's going to do or enacted so far, then this is what the world looks like. I tend to look at two things. Number one, you know, what are the changes in the trends? But then how have these predictions also changed over time? So, you know, if you look back to the 2010 IEA report, for example, what's different now from what they were saying? And then for some things, oil, not a huge change from that time frame. You know, renewable power, massive change in terms of what we foresee globally for renewable power, electric vehicles. So those are, you can really see when you look at older reports of theirs where the real earth-shattering changes have happened.
I think we have seen, I think even here in Alberta, as we've had the conversation around, you know, renewables, that it's expanded, it's grown in Alberta far faster than anybody expected. I mean, is that kind of a microcosm of what we're seeing globally?
Oh, for sure. Like, we're now seeing, for example, on solar, we're seeing probably more solar installed this year than the IEA used to say, well, we might get in total by 2035. So the scale and pace of solar expansion, wind, et cetera, it's just gotten so much cheaper than people would have expected. And so it's opening up opportunities for cheap electricity in parts of the world that, you know, previously haven't had access to that kind of cheap power, doing some of that here. And then, again, we've seen different trends like this over time, whether it was U.S. oil production. You know, for a long time, it was taken for granted that U.S. oil production was down and declining, and it has rebounded to, you know, one of the largest producers in the world. And then, you know, you look at Canada's oil sands, for example. For a long time, there was very limited positive outlook for the oil sands, and then there were massive, maybe overestimates of the growth of the resource, and those have been trimmed back now. So in all of these cases, you see changes over time that tell you maybe more of a story than the forecast in any given year on its own.
So what about the notion that Canada needs to pick a lane here, pick a team, right? Because there's Team Oil and Gas that sees renewables as some kind of a threat or treats them as such. And the other side is that, you know, if we're going to be serious about green energy, how on earth can we have a federal government, you know, buying the Trans Mountain Pipeline or approving LNG Canada, right, in these kinds of projects? But do we have to pick a lane?
Well, I think what I'd rather see us do is be honest with ourselves about what we're basing our decisions on. So are we expecting that the world is going to act on climate change? How aggressively do we think we're going to act? What do we think that means for us as a national economy or as a provincial economy? And then, you know, what opportunities make sense given our view of the world? And I think too often we're devolved to individual projects. You know, LNG Canada is a great example. There are lots of scenarios with global action on climate change where LNG Canada would play an important role in that. But you can paint another scenario, a plausible scenario of the global energy transition, where that becomes a stranded asset, where nobody really wants by, you know, decades into the future, where nobody's interested in producing, shipping, liquefying, shipping, and regasifying Canadian natural gas to Asia or Europe or what have you, are not willing to pay enough to make it worthwhile. So when you get down to individual assets, I think people tend to be too black and white about any individual asset and what we can say about their role in an economy acting on climate change.
Right. But I mean, you know, it's hard to know for certain what the future is going to hold. And there are, I think, preferred scenarios or feared scenarios that maybe guide some of these decisions. But ultimately, governments do have to make decisions.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, my take in the book tends to be that our government policy should be at a higher level. So it shouldn't be individual facility. It should be, what are the policies that if the world implemented, say, carbon pricing, for example, if the world implemented our carbon pricing regime, would we meet global goals? And the answer to that is pretty unequivocally yes. And so that gives our policies
sort of credibility in the world facing climate change and allows our businesses to make decisions about how they want to invest given that policy regime or not invest. It's not then up to governments to say, well, you know, this project's okay, that project's okay. It's letting the market and the price signal sort that out.
Right. And two of the issues you address, and you alluded to them, and it sort of speaks to Canada's place in the world and how relevant we are, how much we matter, both in terms of our size, how much overall we contribute to global emissions. There's also the aspect of Canada's a colder, more northern country. So what do you make of those two issues or arguments as they relate to these conversations?
Well, you know, I think the math on the 2% of global emissions, you can't get away from that. So we can't stand back and say, you know, Canada's going to do whatever, and that's going to mean there are fewer wildfires or less permafrost melting or the glaciers will not recede in Banff National Park or what have you. We don't have that kind of leverage over the global emission system. Mm. But I think we also need to remember that, you know, we still face substantial risks from global action on climate change. And I think, as I argue in the book, we have more of a choice to say, do we want to set our own course or do we want to have our course set for us? So an example, I don't talk about that much in the book, but I think one that will be relevant to your listeners was the Keystone XL pipeline. In the broad scheme of climate change, it's a relatively small project, but it became the center of an entire two presidential elections and a couple of Canadian elections about climate change policy, and ended up being, you know, billions of dollars lost and an opportunity for some lost and for some gained, I suppose, but just over that one project. And so that type of threat remains. And I talk about in the book, for example, the Trans Mountain pipeline, appealing to the Canadian energy regulators, say, please don't tell anyone who our insurance provider is. If you tell anybody, we won't be able to get insurance. And, you know, that's a very striking thing. Doesn't matter how small we are in the global context, that's a real threat to a real project that is important to Canada that comes from, you know, that perceived inaction or insufficient action on climate change. So I think we have to refocus it, not to say how big are we in the global context, but what actions make sense for us given where we sit in the world. And then on the other one, the cold country, I think what I try to do in the book is say, you know, yeah, there are a bunch of studies that assess essentially how does Canada do in a slightly warmer than average year. And Canada, because we've got a lot of agricultural land and a lot of tourism, tends to do well when it's warmer and sunnier and drier climate-wise. But that's not the same as saying, how will Canada do under sustained warming for year after year after year? So, you know, it's like saying, I like hot, sunny days, therefore we'll all be better off in drought conditions. Well, that obviously doesn't hold. Take it further, you know, how are we going to do when we have things like the pine beetle, which occur only or which expand in range because we have sustained warming or increased wildfire risk or northern permafrost melting, or these things that happen because we have sustained warming over time, those aren't going to be picked up in these studies that consistently say Canada will be either not that well, not that badly off, or even maybe a little bit better off because of climate change. So that's sort of the argument I pick up on in that chapter in the book.
So you look at these debates and you look at some of this division in Canada around some of these issues. I mean, where does it leave your level of optimism that, you know, pragmatic, meaningful policy is achievable?
Well, you know, I think we already have that. And even if you look, despite, for example, all the rhetoric around a clean electricity regulation, you know, fundamentally, we're arguing about 5 years, right? The federal regulation talks essentially forces near net zero by 2045. Premier Smith is saying, well, no, we absolutely can't do that. 2050 is the right number.
Right.
You know, if that's the gap we got to close, that's pretty easy. And, you know, looking around the world today, if that's the worst policy chasm we have to close, we're in pretty good shape. And, you know, I think the same thing is true. We talk about Trudeau, and certainly there's no love for Prime Minister Trudeau, or very little in southern Alberta. But, you know, when you think about this is a prime minister who will have led to the construction of the first major pipeline expansion to the West Coast in, you know, 5 decades, basically. And so if the distance we have is the distance between, you know, the Calgary oil and gas CEO and the prime minister who built the pipeline or enabled the pipeline construction of the West Coast. We're not as far off as maybe some of the rhetoric would lead us to believe.
Well, we'll leave it on a cheerful note. The book is called Between Doom and Denial. The event, it's happening tomorrow at Studio Bell. Andrew Leach will be in conversation with Calgary Chamber CEO Deborah Yedlin. There's going to be a Q&A as well. It's happening, as mentioned, tomorrow at Studio Bell. Andrew, thank you so much for making some time for us here this afternoon. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Looking forward to seeing everyone tomorrow night.
All the best. There you go. That's Andrew Leach, energy and environmental economist, professor at the University of Alberta, author of Between Doom and Denial. And so he will be delivering the McGill Max Bell Lecture Series this year, the event happening tomorrow night here in Calgary. More details at McGill.ca. Good afternoon. Welcome to this hour of the program. Rob Breckenridge with you here on a Tuesday afternoon. You can reach us 403-974-8255, 974-TALK. A lot more still to get to here this afternoon. We'll get some of your phone calls coming up after 1:30. But off the top in this hour, there's been a lot of talk about the impact of short-term rentals on the overall rental market, or really the overall housing market. Like, if we've got properties that are basically designated to be short-term rentals, that kind of takes them out of the equation when it comes to the overall housing stock. And if there's less supply, doesn't that mean higher prices? I mean, on top of that, we've seen a couple of trends in recent years. We've seen, obviously, an increase in housing prices, an increase in rents. And we've seen an increase in listings on sites like Airbnb. But is that a causal relationship? And basically, are these short-term rentals increasing the cost of housing? Now, there's increased focus on this. I mean, Calgary right now is in the process of reviewing some of the regulations around short-term rentals. BC has just brought in legislation aimed at cracking down on this. Now, the federal government, in applauding what BC is doing, has said that they're going to look at what they might be able to do under their jurisdiction to deal with this as well. So what does the evidence tell us about the impact of short-term rentals? Well, as it happens, there's a new study from the Conference Board of Canada that takes a look at this specific question and finds that sites like Airbnb generate no meaningful increase in rent across Canada. So joining us now to talk more about this is the author of the report. Tony Bonin is Director of Economic Research at the Conference Board of Canada, conferenceboard.ca. Tony, good to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be here.
All right. So give us a bit more then on the background here of what it was you were looking at and why you felt this was something that needed to be scrutinized more closely.
Yeah, I think you set up the question we were trying to tackle quite well, which is this question around, is there a causal relation between short-term rentals, which are growing in frequency across the country, no doubt, mm-hmm. with the increase that we've seen in rent? So we worked with Airbnb to use their record-level data. So, in fact, this is the first report of its kind where we're using data directly from Airbnb rather than scraped from their website and so on, to try and look at exactly what's happening at the neighborhood level and compare the degree of Airbnb activity against data from the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation and their rental prices. We see a very clear correlation, and it's a very meaningful, statistically significant correlation between Airbnb activity and rental price increases. But once we got down to that neighborhood level and were able to control for neighborhood-specific factors, like a downtown core has mm-hmm. more Airbnbs and rents have been increasing there more quickly, once you can control for those neighborhood-level effects, we can't find any causal explanation coming from Airbnb activity itself in explaining why rents have been increasing so much in recent years.
Right. So you come up with a number here. So we've seen about a 30% increase in rents since 2016 in this period you looked at. But you say of that, at most, less than one percentage point could be attributed to Airbnb activity.
Yeah, that's right. And over that same period, so over the 2016 to 2022 period we were looking at, Airbnb activity, I mean, frankly, exploded in Canada. It went from a fairly new entrant into the market and short-term rentals and increased roughly threefold in terms of these high-use, high-frequency rentals. But even with that increase, Airbnb's overall footprint in the stock of housing is relatively small as of today. And so it just isn't a large enough piece of the overall stock of housing to really be impacting prices. And that's the main explanation for why we had this result, which I'll say, frankly, we were surprised by. We were expecting to see some causal relationship, but couldn't find anything, no matter how we tested the data, really.
And that's interesting. And I think it does fly in the face of a lot of assumptions that are driving some of this debate. So why do you think then so many of these assumptions get it wrong?
So a lot of the data that's out there, a lot of the existing research is quite in line with what we have found. The big difference is that the variation in rents and the variation in Airbnb activity is really across geographies. There's big differences between, say, downtown Calgary and like Red Deer, for example, right, as opposed to over time. The changes over time aren't as big as cross-sectionally, as we say, or across geographies. And because we had this really localized data, we were able to start controlling for that. And that's something other studies haven't been able to do. And so they end up looking more so at the changes over time. And if you look at changes over time, you're more likely to pick up this correlation, increase in rents and Airbnb activity, rather than discerning what's happening at that individual level. And I will add just that we did look at changes over time as well as changes across different geographies. So we had both dimensions there, but it was a result of the large amount of data that we had, 330 neighborhoods in the model we used.
What's different in Quebec? This report finds that Quebec's a bit of an exception here, that there was a more measurable impact of Airbnb.
Yeah, so because we weren't able to find a clear causal link, we cut the data in a number of different ways. And one way we cut the data was to look at province-specific effects. And here, we didn't see any effects in Alberta or BC, but in Quebec, we did find a meaningful, that is, statistically significant relationship. The main explanation we have is the prevalence of Airbnb in some of the downtown neighborhoods in Quebec City and Montreal, where it has, you know, an outsized share, particularly downtown Quebec, because it's such a tourist destination. There's a lot of interest to stay there. But given that we didn't see any kind of causal relations like that in other provinces, we didn't think that was a huge impact. And indeed, even in Quebec, that effect, that meaningful effect we saw there is relatively small in terms of magnitude.
Right. So overall, and I mean, you know, with the maybe what's a disproportionate focus in terms of what we're getting from policymakers, that if we're concerned about housing affordability, that a focus on short-term rentals, it's not likely to yield any kind of measurable impact there.
That's correct. Right now, for the level of short-term rentals, and I should clarify, we are looking just at Airbnb, so not other short-term rental organizations. Airbnb is certainly the largest. At today's level of activity, it's just not that big. We estimated that on average, Airbnb represents about 0.5% of the overall stock of housing in Canadian cities. That's not a big section of the supply of housing. When CMHC, for example, suggests we need to increase housing supply by 30% over the next decade to bring affordability back to the housing market.
Right. And I guess even if we look at the total number, if we just look at Airbnb listings, are you focusing on those that are sort of full-time Airbnb listings? Because there's an important distinction, I guess, between someone who rents out the property that they also live in and some of these units that are almost permanent Airbnb listings.
Yeah, that's right. So, and this is consistent with the other literature that's out there. By looking at those homes that have been rented out for more than 30 nights in the past 3 months, that's what we call high-use Airbnbs, and that's what we focused on in our data. And that effectively rules out places that people rent out when they go away for a long weekend.
Yeah,
these are really
okay.
Places dedicated to those short-term rentals.
All right, very interesting. Much more at conferenceboard.ca. Tony, thanks so much for joining us here this afternoon. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
Take care. Tony Bonan, Director of Economic Research at the Conference Board of Canada, author of this report. So even coming as a bit of a surprise to them that there doesn't seem to be a big impact. So looking at the period from 2016 to 2022, rents over that period increased. Airbnb listings over that period increased. So was there a causal relationship? What they find based on their research is that of the 30% average increase in rents, at most less than 1 percentage point of that can be attributed to Airbnb activity. So bedbugs. Bedbugs are gross. People get very queasy when we talk about bedbugs. You know, bedbugs, I mean, mosquitoes also feed on our blood. I mean, bedbugs aren't the only insects that do that. But I think the idea that they're hiding, they're lurking under the surface, they attack us when we're sleeping, like they violate us by crawling under our covers and doing this to us while we sleep. Maybe that kind of bothers us. Maybe that makes it a little more creepy. And the weird thing, too, bedbugs, they don't fly. They don't even really jump. Like, not only do we provide them sustenance, we move them around. We help spread them. So bedbugs are a problem, and we're kind of a part of that problem. But we would just as soon avoid them. Right. And so when we hear about bed bugs, it gets a lot of attention. There's some stories in August and into September. There had been a number of Las Vegas casinos where there'd been complaints or they'd had issues with bed bugs. But maybe the biggest story or the most headlines have come out of Paris, where it seems like there's been a real crisis there. I mean, Paris is a big city, a lot of people coming and going from Paris. I mean, you know, they got the Summer Olympics coming up there next year. So folks there are concerned about the problem of bedbugs. It's become a political controversy. It's also become, according to French intelligence, a source of disinformation. French intelligence believe that Russian troll farms have been trying to contribute to the panic by spreading fake stories about bedbugs. So definitely there's a lot more interest in the topic. Searches for bedbugs are up substantially, but our actual bedbug numbers. Is there a crisis unfolding here? Well, joining us to talk more about it is someone who's a bit of an expert in this field. Mark Johnson is a biology professor at the University of Toronto and joins us on the line here this afternoon. Mark, great to have you with us here. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me on.
So you specialize in, you know, urban insects, I guess, for lack of a better term. So this is an area you study closely. Have you noticed any substantial changes over the last few years or even over the last, say, 5 or 10 years?
So if we go back to the last 20 years, there has been a steady uptick in the abundance of bedbugs compared to post-World War II, where they became very, very rare. But over the last 5 years, and particularly in the last few years, the abundance is not substantially greater than it was 5 years ago. And in fact, there is some evidence that it dipped during the pandemic because people weren't moving around as much.
Right.
So the current obsession in the media with this is more with media and social media hype as opposed to actual data.
Yeah, which is encouraging, I guess, in a way, but it also speaks to an interesting preoccupation we have with bedbugs. Does it seem disproportionate to you?
Well, you know, people are certainly concerned about bedbugs for the reasons that you mentioned. They're things that we can't readily see. They suck our blood. We're often fearful of things that suck our blood. Importantly, bedbugs do not carry any known human diseases, so that's a good thing, but they do cause a lot of discomfort. So yeah. When they do in fact infest an area and they do bite people, you know, that can be quite itchy and can be quite uncomfortable, but it also creates just a lot of stress in individuals knowing that they have a bed bug infestation potentially. You know, no one likes, there's a stigma associated with that, and it used to be thought that bed bugs would infest areas with low economic areas, and really they don't discriminate at this point. They get into wherever they can, whether it be in places of that have lower economic areas or higher economic areas. They will go where they travel. Mm-hmm. And so they're not very discriminating, but they're largely a nuisance. They're not really a public health concern, though, other than the itching that they cause when they do infest and bite.
So it does seem like they have an issue right now in Paris. But what's your sense of what's going on in Paris right now?
Yeah, my sense is that there was some well-publicized newspaper articles. There was a politician who brought in a vial full of dead bed bugs. And so it's the issue that they're having is more hype than actual fact.
Yeah.
There are bed bugs in Paris for sure, but there's also bed bugs in Toronto, in London, in Calgary, in Vancouver. You know, there are bed bugs in a lot of places now, and you know, trying to understand why they've increased is important, and how we can control them is also important. But the hype that's happening right now is a little overblown. What I understand, Paris is not worse than other cities.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I mean, Paris is a tourist destination. Las Vegas, which I mentioned, is a tourist destination. So when you got a lot of people traveling to and from a location like that, that can contribute to this, right? I mean, bed bugs, they catch a ride with us.
Absolutely. As you mentioned, they don't fly around. They walk around. They get into people's luggage. They can get into people's clothes. They can get into people's furniture. So if, you know, furniture is being sold or used furniture is being traded, then it can travel that way. But I think the way it mostly travels bed bugs today is through people traveling, as you're mentioning. So as you go from a hotel, if bed bugs get into your luggage and then you go home, they can move that way. And they like to find little dark crevices where they can hide, and they're not easily seen, and so you won't notice it at first until they start biting you when they get into wherever you're staying.
They can be tough to kill. That's part of the challenge too, as I understand, and we've seen, you know, where they've developed some resistance to some insecticides. You need a little more extreme hot or cold conditions to really do them in. So is that part of the challenge then? And once you've got a situation, what do you do about it?
Yeah, that's definitely part of the challenge. So post-World War II, there was a lot of use of insecticides to control bed bugs, and they were very, very effective. Things like DDT. More recently, they've been using different pyrethroids to control them, especially deltamethrin. And these were extremely effective, killing virtually all of the bed bugs. But at some point, a bed bug arose that had a genetic mutation that made it resistant to some of these insecticides, and they passed on their genes to their progeny because they were not being killed as effectively as the other ones.
All right.
And through time, they've gathered a number of different mutations that allow them to resist a variety of these insecticides that are being applied. So there's multiple ways in which they can evade the conventional insecticide methods. And that's one of the reasons, that's part of the story about why they've increased in abundance. We started seeing an uptick in the late 1990s, early 2000s, and it's been kind of a steady uptick till about the pandemic, and then it dipped down, and it's resurging to where it was pre-pandemic levels because mm-hmm. people are moving around again. And so the control aspect is definitely related to this insecticide resistance that has built up. You know, in an early study in about 2010, they found in the United States, 88% of all the individuals had some level of resistance to insecticides. And that was 2010. We're 13 years on. And so most bed bugs that you see now will have some level of resistance to these insecticides. So we need to use other methods for controlling them as well. Like you mentioned, if you go to Health Canada, they recommend using steam cleaning, vacuuming with HEPA filters, but then you also have to wash clothes, and if you can, put some smaller items in freezers. All of these are kind of a broad mechanism of defense against bed bugs.
Some good advice, some important information. We'll leave it there. Professor Johnson, thanks again for joining us here this afternoon. Much appreciated.
Thank you. Have a great day.
All the best. That's biologist Mark Johnson, the University of Toronto, runs the Evo Eco Lab, evoeco.org. There's done a lot of research on urbanization and insects. So basically saying there's a lot of panic right now, unnecessary panic around bed bugs. Even in Paris, it seems as though people are kind of freaking out. And it's disproportionate, at least in terms of the actual situation. So it's easy to stir up emotion around this. Like, it seems like an icky topic. You know, people just don't want to have to deal with this. again, I mean, some of it is just our own kind of sense of what creeps us out. Yeah, it's an insect that bites us and consumes our blood, but people don't react the same way to mosquitoes, right? So it's different. Mosquitoes, I guess, are easier to kill, maybe. But I think even just the size or the shape of mosquitoes, I think it's something about what a bed bug looks like, too. I mean, they're pretty small. So he said, look, they don't spread diseases. You're not in danger if you get a bed bug bite, but, you know, they can be tricky to deal with.
Thanks for downloading and listening to the podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review for free at Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or wherever you find your podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Rob Breckenridge. And you can email me, rob@770chqr.com. Talk to you next time.
Canada may be known for its landscapes and friendly people, but beneath the surface lies a darker side of crime, history, and the paranormal. Since 2017, the award-winning Dark Poutine podcast has explored the shadowy corners of the Great White North and beyond, delivering chilling tales from a uniquely Canadian perspective. Hosted by Mike Brown and Matthew Stockton, with over 300 episodes and fresh releases every Monday, Dark Poutine is your weekly ticket to the creepier side of Canada. Listen to Dark Poutine on Apple, Spotify, Amazon Music, or wherever you get your podcasts.